like to declare this meeting of the Legacy Division, the House of Representatives, in order. And don't have a quorum yet, so we won't approve the minutes yet. Today, we have several bills before us. Then we'll have a presentation by the Greater Minnesota Park and Trail Coalition, and then other funding request presentations. We will be laying all of these items over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill that we will be putting together. The first, actually from the printed agenda that you may have, we're flip-flopping House File 499 Davids with House File 450 Cornish. If Representative Davids were here, he could get in front of the...
He was here. I saw him.
He is the chair of the Tax Committee. We do, you know, we normally do whatever he wants. Representative Cornish, do you have your guitar? Would you care to play a few tunes as we wait?
A cappella or something.
If he doesn't get here, we'll be playing.
There he comes.
Representative, and here he is, ladies and gentlemen, the chair of the Tax Committee, Representative Greg Davids. Welcome, Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House, could someone move? Do we have a quorum?
No, we don't.
Okay, House File 499 is an appropriation for the Chatfield Center for the Arts, and I have several folks who would like to testify on behalf of the bill.
Welcome to the committee.
I have Mr. Mike Martin to my immediate right, and Judge Joe Chase has joined us from the city of Chatfield also.
So we have Chase Martin.
Or, yes.
Or Martin Chase. It sounds like a bank. Begin, please. Identify yourselves again as for the record, and welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Michael Martin. I'm a volunteer with the Chatfield Center for the Arts. With me is Judge Joe Chase. He's a volunteer performer in the center and also just a general arts practitioner. Behind us, we have Joel Young, who's the city clerk in Chatfield, and also Mayor Don Hayman, who's the mayor of Chatfield. The Chatfield Center for the Arts is a $9.5 million project, of which $2.5 million has already been committed locally in the form of cash or property. It will result in the reinvigoration of arts performance and display venue that has served all of southeastern Minnesota for more than 75 years. The project intends to rehabilitate a gymnasium auditorium built as a PWA project in 1935 into a state-of-the-art performing arts venue and convert the attached school building, constructed in 1916, into a modern display center, event support space, and space for arts-related activity of all kinds. Minnesota Statute Section 129D.17, Subdivision 2A, states that funds from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund may only be spent on arts, arts education, and arts access. Maintaining these structures meets all of those goals. Arts must have a venue and support space in order to be displayed and to live on. And what better way to educate aspiring artists than to provide them space to practice their craft? And art access must be more than free tickets. It must also include providing facilities that allow everyone to enjoy the performances and displays in a convenient, safe, and healthy environment. 2011 will mark the sixth consecutive decade of community theater in the auditorium portion of the building. The Chatfield Brass Band, the Marine Corps Band, The Air Force Academy Choir, school bands, and choirs from all of southern Minnesota have made their music there. Just the spring 2011 calendar of events includes performances by the St. Olaf Norseman Band, Lori Line, the Chatfield High School One Act and Spring Plays, as well as Chatfield's annual Memorial Day tribute. Todd Green will also take the stage with his performance of Ethnic Instruments. Minnesota statutes further state that the funds are to be used to preserve Minnesota's history and cultural heritage. By rehabilitating and retasking these buildings, this project will preserve an important part of Minnesota's history. The Potter Auditorium has been described as the finest and most complete example of PWA architecture still in existence. The 1916 High School is an equally complete example of the architecture and the construction of that period. Every definition of culture that I know of has included architecture as one of the elements that define it. The final sentence in this subdivision calls for projects to incorporate state-of-the-art technology. The purpose of this project is to modernize those systems and the structures, not using not only the best current artistic design, but also the best building design practices using the B3 and LEED guidelines. Our project is based on a strong commitment of a community that understands and supports the arts and cultural heritage of our state, and we believe fulfills the vision of the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Our mutual goal should be that these kind of performances may continue to inspire appreciation for the arts by residents of southeastern Minnesota and to provide them with an affordable venue in which to participate themselves in arts-related activities. And now I'd like to ask Judge Joe Chase, who is probably one of our most successful products of the arts program.
I don't know about that. I'll be as brief as I can.
Welcome, Judge Chase.
Thank you very much.
Identify yourself again, please.
I'm Joe Chase. I'm from Chatfield, Minnesota, Chair Erdahl, and I grew up on the stage of Potter Auditorium. My mom's, in 1936, was the first high school graduating class to graduate from that stage. I grew up there. I'm proud to say that my daughter grew up there in every show that she could get into on that stage. I chair our local community theater organization. We do a big musical every year on the stage of Potter Auditorium. Last year, year before last, it was Brigadoon. Last year, Footloose. This coming year, you're the first to hear about it. It will be The King and I. And then next year, we're going to depart from our usual musical production. Next year, we're going to do a show that commemorates the sesquicentennial of the Dakota War with a show that highlights what the Chatfield Boys did in the first 24 hours of that war as the garrison at Fort Ridgely.
You piqued my interest.
I knew I would. Potter Auditorium, if Potter Auditorium didn't exist, our theater group would not exist. We're a town of 2,000 people, yet we do a show that involves 40 to 50 performers, musicians, and others every summer. We bring in about 2,000 people to see those shows. But Potter Auditorium is showing its age. It's a wonderful example of New Deal architecture, but it needs to be brought now into the 21st century. It's been a legacy to us from our great-grandparents. We want to leave it as a legacy to our great-grandchildren with the same kind of arts presentations that we are currently doing in Chatfield. That's what I wanted to tell you about here today.
I think, Mr. Chairman, we'll stand for questions.
Any questions? This is a sizable investment. Have you done anything so far? Have you started the project at all?
Mr. Chairman, yes, the project has been underway, and the facility has been has never missed a beat in maintaining its presence in Chatfield. We did 2010 and 2009. We did our annual musical performances. I believe since the EDA has taken over the building, which is just over a year, Joel, could you give me the number? About 8,000 people have either participated in arts-related events or attended performances in that building. We've received roughly $75,000 to $80,000 in grants and other activities. We've let a contract for some site preparation and demolition work. So things are happening, and tomorrow evening we will be completing the process to select an architect for the project. So we have been working.
So this is something that you're comfortable in doing in stages. I mean, frankly, I'm guessing $7 million in 1 year won't turn out, but
the project is designed so that it can be phased. We do know where the natural breakpoints are. Yes.
And Mr. Chairman, a little
Representative
bit more history on this project. This was in the bonding bill. The legislature, the House and Senate last year saw the wisdom of including this project in the bonding bill, but for some reason, Governor Plenty respectfully disagreed. That wasn't so respectfully. He disagreed. And so there is a history here. It has gone through the bonding process before. It's been through the committees. It's been passed previously, and we think it's a very worthy project.
Representative Davis, does this have anything to do with the sheet music library?
I'll let Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chairman, as with almost any other arts-related activity, there will be space made available to the Brass Band Lending Library. Whether they choose to use it, we can't speak for them. They are under the governance of a different board, but space will be made available to them.
Okay, thank you. Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have you entered into any public-private partnerships, like with the school district, the city, or anybody else in funding this project?
Mr. Chairman,
Martin.
Representative McFarland, yes, we have. The school district originally owned both of the properties, and they have deeded it over to the city, actually the Economic Development Authority of the City of Chatfield. It's currently being managed by a 7-member volunteer advisory committee. All of us are private citizens. So yes, we've got the public involved, the private sector's involved. We've received grants from private foundations. We're getting everybody involved that we can.
Mr. Chair, and how about the city?
McFarland.
How about the city? Are they?
Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McFarland, the city is actually the paying agent for this. They are putting the bills through the Economic Development Authority, and they are providing us with not only the services of the city clerk, but also of the city historian to help on this project. So everybody's involved.
Representative Guineas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Davids, folks up here. I was on the bonding committee last year and totally supported this effort. I was on the conference committee and totally supported this effort. What I'm wrestling with here is that was the bonding committee where we do, if I could say it, earmarks. And Mr. Chair, we have not had a conversation about are we going to be doing earmarks in this committee or are we going to be doing competitive grants? And that seems to be the underlying conversation that we need to have. I'd certainly, in a bonding bill, would be the first, or not the first, it would be one of the votes to make sure this happened in a bonding bill. I think it's totally appropriate, a bonding bill.
Representative Guineas, a likely path for the things we are considering is that they would be referred from here to the proper dispersal entity, being that in this case the Historical Society or the Arts Board or whatever.
Thank you.
Further discussion? Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Davids, I guess I'm wondering about your feelings on supplanting versus supplementing. If this was passed by the legislature for the bonding bill, it was vetoed, and that happened, you know, at the state capitol, and then there was a campaign in which projects like this were the subject of political attack by the party that's now in the majority. And now we're getting requests to, instead of using bonding dollars, which were attacked, to use legacy funds instead. And to me, that sounds like something that is supplanting rather than supplementing. And I don't know how to make sense of that, I guess. I don't know when we should start using legacy funds on projects that are perfectly good candidates for the bonding bill, but for whatever reason are squeezed out even after the legislature has approved them.
Representative Davids?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much, Representative Winkler. My theory would be, or my thought would be, that you can't supplant something you never had. This never became law, so it's not something that was there previously. And under the leadership of Chair Murphy, when a lot of these issues were talked about the last 2 years in this committee, that's a very big deal. It's a very big issue, and that does need to be thought through very carefully. And I've thought through that very question, and to me, supplanting would be taking away something that's there. This was never there.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, follow-up. So let's assume for right now that we don't have a bonding bill of any size this year, and instead we do it next year, which is traditionally when we would do a large bonding bill. And the bill that comes forward and passes doesn't have any funds for regional or local arts facilities. And in previous bills, we've had that. But what if we don't have any this time, but we have projects that come through legacy? Doesn't that start to look like supplanting?
Representative Davids?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not. I mean, and Mr. Chairman, I just, like I said, I don't understand how you could possibly be supplanting something that doesn't exist. It's not there. It hasn't been there. It's never been law. Now, to the committee, I think I'm going to amend this to say the International Chatfield Center for the Arts, because this does have has had visitors from overseas, from how many foreign countries, and it is truly of regional significance and some. But you ask a very, very important question, and what I'm looking at is also, if you'll notice, we're going down dual tracks. We're taking this thing out for a spin here. We'll be looking at the bonding, and I put that in so that it could be looked at for next year's bonding bill and go through the scrutiny that previous legislatures have given it. So I think it's very interesting, and the committee has some decisions to make. Can we work on bricks and mortar here, or is it strictly programming money? And that's a decision the committee will have to make. What the law says is that, in fact, Mr. Martin has informed us of what the law says, and nowhere does it say in there that we're not able to use it for bricks and mortar. So this committee has some decisions to make, and your point is very well taken, and those are the issues that we'll have to wrestle with to come to a conclusion here.
Mr. Chair, I guess the final point.
One more.
Yeah, if we have, just to hit it one more time, if historically we've averaged, just picking a random number out of the sky, $50 million in cultural or arts-type capital projects at a bonding bill, and that's been an average, and then suddenly in 2012 that zeroed out, and at the same time legacy funds kick in and start paying for capital projects when they didn't do that before, doesn't that start to look like supplanting?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, that argument could certainly be made.
Thank you. With that, I'll just make this suggestion, Dr. Chase. We have been trying. I've been encouraging that there be a play that Representative Davids has a part in. And this last week, I was in St. Cloud at the Pioneer Theater, and they've done some fine renovation there using some legacy money. And King Banyan has performed there. And I was thinking if you could bring Representative Banyan down to Chatfield, and with Representative Davids, I think the King and I would be a...
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was looking more forward to the 2 years. I mean, certainly it'll be an excellent production. They always are. next year with the King and I, but when they talk about the Indian Wars that you've written books on, I think he may need to try to throw in the parts, Judge Chase.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The bill will be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Now, Representative Cornish, House File 450. Representative Cornish, are you ready?
Yes, I am. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. House File 450 is for an appropriation, and similar probably to the last one, I don't know what you're thinking of. Mr. Chairman, you said something about possibly going to the Historical Society and dole out the funds from there if successful. But House File 450 is appropriation for money for a historical bridge down in my area in Blue Earth County, and I didn't even notice it until looking through the talking points that are being handed out to you now that Blue Earth County supported the legacy amendment with the largest percentage of yes votes in the state. So with me today is Lisa Dierke, a community organizer and small business owner in Amboy, and a friend of hers, Mr. Les Curry, and they're going to help me make the presentation, and I'll turn it over to Ms. Dierke for the rest of the presentation. I'll be available for questions, and if we could bring Mr. Keller down from the Historical Society, not necessarily for up, thumbs up or down, but just tell him how it would integrate into the program and if there would be a place for it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cornish, for your interest in our project here, and thank you for giving us the opportunity to talk about our bridge.
Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record.
I'm Lisa Dierke Lindberg. Actually, Lisa Lindberg. I am a small business owner in Amboy. I actually run the Amboy Cottage Cafe, which is in a refurbished gas station. And I want to give you a little sense of our community that would embrace a project like the bridge. We're a small community south of Mankato, have about 600 active members. Our main street is small, but we've chosen to capitalize on our historic properties. The town was founded around 1879 with a focus on railroad transport. The bridge that we're talking about was built in 1901 to connect farming product to the railroad, which existed in town, and move it throughout the world.
You go ahead and talk. I'll show.
We'll pass the photos around a little bit so you can see them a little bit better. But Amboy is a small community. We have one block of historic buildings, and we utilized a $500,000 small cities grant completed in October of 2008 to refurbish our main street. Community members are active. The main street is streets. Stores are participating in the community actively. They are full. We have nothing for sale at this point in time on our main street. The buildings, around the turn of the century was when these buildings were refurbished too, and utilizing the main street program and SHPO to consult with us, they were taken back to that time frame where we could. So you can take a look at those and see what you're missing there is our full-service gas station and our grain elevator we're renovating, a country schoolhouse that we've renovated. From my place in the kitchen at the cafe, I'm in a unique position to look at what our community resources are, why people come to visit Amboy. I work with the youth, I serve the middle age, and older people who come in and talk with the visitors who eat in the cafe. Historic tourism definitely has a place for our small towns, and it is helping our town to blossom. In with that, just a mile and a half southwest of town, we have the Dodd-Ford Bridge, built in 1901 by the L.H. Johnson Company. It is now on the National Historic Register, registered in December of 2009. We've developed a community that supports the Dodd-Ford Bridge preservation, and you have some of the points on the handout I gave to you here. Lawrence Henry Johnson was a House representative for 8 years and actually served as Speaker of the House in 1907. The bridge that that we have southwest of Amboy is close enough to have been actively involved in recreation for town kids and town folk for years and years. Traditional biking out to the bridge with your fishing pole and just getting away from town. It's on the Minnesota Snowmobile Trail, so when the bridge was open, snowmobiles would cross it. Closed in May of 2009 by the county to vehicular traffic, so at this point it is closed. Continues to be on the Minnesota Birding Trail, a place for bicyclists to go to. There's some DNR interest in developing an aquatic management area down there, and the Mankato Paddling and Outings Club has had several outings from there, and people regularly canoe up and down the river. We would also be looking to do a canoe landing. This looks just like a pile of metal to some people, but it is a very interesting pile of metal. It's a Pratt Truss bridge. It does have a wooden deck, which is kind of unique. It's a camelback, and the design is unique enough that this is one of three or four left in the state of Minnesota. Engineering design is unique. It uses a small amount of material to create a very strong structure. Anyway, the bridge is important to us in Amboy. It fits in with our community. It can be a draw for historic tourism. It is on the National Register. And at this point in time, we have utilized two of the legacy grants to bring the bridge to the point we are now. And first of all, we used a small legacy grant paired with a National Trust grant to have engineering studies done that would determine whether the bridge was rehabilitatable at all. That done, then, the statistics and information from that preliminary engineering study were used to write a grant application for a larger legacy grant, which we received $110,000 to do the detailed engineering planning that is preparatory to actual renovation and construction. At this point in time, Blue Earth County is working together with the Dodd-Ford Bridge Preservation Society. The county has agreed to retain ownership of the bridge and maintain the roadway. Together, we looked at and hired the engineering firm to do the detailed engineering. And by the end of April 2011, it should be shovel-ready. At this point in time, we're asking for $972,000, which would do the actual construction and complete the project. Questions?
Do we have any questions? Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, is the bridge in use now?
Representative Cornish?
Currently, I think the only use it has is closed right now for vehicular traffic. Do the ATVs and snowmobiles use it yet?
No, it's closed.
It's going to be renovated, I believe, for light traffic, not vehicle traffic anymore.
It would be renovated for recreational traffic only, and this was kind of in consensus with the county. Dealing with even four-wheel traffic across it probably will not be a possibility. But snowmobile, bicycle, horseback, pedestrian.
Okay. And the two small grants that you received were from the Historical Society?
One was a Legacy Heritage and Cultural Grant for $3,000, a National Trust Grant for $3,000. Those were combined, and that is what the preliminary engineering studies were done with. The $110,000 grant then is being utilized currently to write the detailed engineering planning, which needs to precede actual construction. SEH is the company that's been hired to do that and is working on the project.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Then when this is complete and restored, then it's going to be used for a canoe path. It's going to be used for a landing for boating. And it's going to be used for what other purposes?
The area would be used for canoeing. It would not actually come off of the bridge. Surrounding property has been donated then for the development of a simple canoe landing. Currently, the bridge is a center for recreational activity, as it always has been for our community. People still fish down there. Canoes come on by and go through. You can go down there. It's a little awkward. Because we don't actually have a canoe landing. But it's used currently as a recreational site for our community.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Representative Cornish, then that draws me to what my first questions were, but I wanted to make sure I understood it. Why are we asking for money from the Arts and Cultural Fund rather than from the Clean Water Fund or from the Parks and Trails Fund or from the Outdoor Heritage Fund?
Representative Cornish.
Well, we're asking it from this, Mr. Chairman, because of the cultural heritage in this specific location. And we've already gotten money. Representative Wagenius was kind enough to include in her omnibus bill last year to designate this as a water trail going underneath the bridge with a possible up to $60,000 spend on that system there and signage and access. And so it's kind of a cooperative project between the state and the federal and the county. And this seemed like the best place that we had to that fit our need to get the funding from.
And
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, with the goals and outcomes that are listed that the committee adopted in the past 2 years.
Representative Cornish.
You think that it fits the Arts and Cultural Fund better than the Parks and Trails or the Clean Water or the Outdoor Heritage?
Representative Murphy, Mr. Chair, yes, I do. The county really has no interest in making it into a park system or anything really to do with a park that much. They'd rather keep it for access and the historical and cultural heritage. And we went that route, actually. The thought about the park, but the availability of the land in the area, it suited our needs best just to preserve it as a historical site and canoe access.
Mr. Chair,
Murphy.
I won't go any further into this now, but I don't understand if we're going to spend $972,000 to complete and restore the bridge, what we're going to do with it once it's restored and completed. I don't understand that part.
Mr. Chair,
are you going to have concerts on it? Is that where the tuba players are going to be, or is what? Are we just going to walk across? Is it part of a? I don't get that part, but
Mr. Chair,
Representative Cornish,
the bridge was closed for vehicular traffic, and the county is cooperating with the Dodd-Ford Bridge people in the state so far to renovate it to get it in use for a snowmobile, an ATV. Hiking, horseback, just about everything except the vehicular traffic. So we think it'll be a high use for the area and quite a draw for the community.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, I'm reminded of a project that Representative Purcell has pursued or will pursue in Bemidji for a snowmobile bridge across a busy section of state highway just outside the city of Bemidji, and it's not, there's no bridge there right now. They're going to build a new one, so they're not restoring an old bridge, but they're building one, and that doesn't come out of legacy. It comes out of parks and trails, or even better, capital investment. And so I guess I would, you know, I guess because this is an old bridge, basically creating the exact same kind of connection puts this in the legacy fund. But my question is, these previous grants, the $110,000 grant and the $3,000 grant, what was the process that you went through to receive grant funding?
We applied.
Ms. Lindberg.
Mr. Chairman, we applied using the regular grant process to get those two grants competitive and receive them.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I guess that's what I assumed to be the case. I just wanted to be sure that we understood that that was a competitive process that you went through.
Yep.
And I certainly am a strong believer in protecting our historic places and think that we should find available funds to protect things and to make this a more valuable asset in your community. The thing that, as you might be able to tell, we struggle with is understanding whether the legacy fund is the appropriate source of funds for a project like this, or whether it's capital in nature, or if it's more like a park or trail connection. And so you don't care, you just want your bridge project to work, but it's something
actually
that we're struggling with.
Oops.
Ms. Lindberg.
Mr. Chair. The historical nature of the bridge, it is on the National Register. It was important to the development of our area. Our people tell stories surrounding the bridge. Once the bridge is gone, those stories cease to exist. So for us, it also is very historical in nature. And the long-term, long-existent recreational use the bridge has seen pulls it all together. It's something that our community is focused on. You know, it's historical heritage, the historic tourism, draws in community and visitors from the outside, and the bridge is just an integral part of that, and will assist in our little village really continuing to exist.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't disagree with anything that you've said. And the other component of it is a competitive grant process is where projects like yours can really come to the fore. And one thing, so it's not just the source of the funds, but it's also the mechanism for delivering funds and determining which projects are most worthy and needy and most urgent and should receive a priority. So sometimes working through the legislative process and going forward with the bill isn't the best way of determining the merit, where I think your project would really rise to the top.
Mr. Chair, would it be okay with you to just, in closing, to have the Mr. Keller make a couple comments?
Representative Cornish, there he is, poised and ready to go. Mr. Kelleher, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society. Might be helpful to just go back for a quick second to the language that's in the Constitution that says that the purpose of the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund is in part to preserve Minnesota's history. I think this is one area where we can use these dollars for, to use the term bricks and mortar, which may not actually apply here. This bridge is on the National Register of Historic Places. It's been determined by the National Park Service and the U.S. Department of the Interior to be an important part of our state's history and our nation's history. In designing a grant program last year, we determined, working with you to come up with the language that was in the appropriation bill, that these types of projects were eligible for grants. And I think that's an important point here, that you told us and we implemented a competitive grant process. We took in hundreds and hundreds of applications. This project, because it's on the National Register, this is a great project. These guys have come together with a grassroots community effort. They've built community support. They've turned around a skeptical, if not hostile, county engineer. And this is a real great success story. And we applaud them for all the work that they've done. But I think the questions before you are questions of process and funding amounts. I think this project has demonstrated the large needs that are out there for preserving historic resources. This is a lot of money. This would be about 20 or 30% of the amount of money that was appropriated last year. So there are some needs out there, and it's a question of how much is available and what kind of a process we're going to use. Again, these guys competed well in that competitive grants process, and we think that that process worked well, and we hope that you implement a process like that again in this round.
Thank you. Thank you all. Now, Representative Detmer with House File 105. Welcome, Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Chair Erdahl.
Were you out in the hall celebrating any particular occasion?
Chairman, no, I wasn't. I was in a little conference.
Is it true that it's your birthday today?
Yes, it is.
Well, happy birthday, Representative Detmer.
Thank you.
You'll never see 39 again.
The big 6-0.
Okay. Well, welcome to the committee and happy birthday.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Chair. I do have an amendment to put the bill in order for this committee. The A1 amendment I'd like to move.
Representative McNamara?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to bring House File 105 before the committee for possible inclusion, and I'd like to move it. Did you say it's the A1 amendment?
That's correct.
The A1 amendment to get the bill in shape the author would like.
Any discussion? Those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment passes and is now in the form that you'd like.
Thank you, Chair Erdahl and committee members. This bill originally came through the Chair Lanning's committee, the state government finance, and had a great discussion during that committee, and Representative Kahn suggested that we also bring the bill to this committee, so that's why the A1 amendment. And the Disabled Veterans Rest Camp is in my district, in the southeastern part of my district, on Big Marine Lake. And I'm not going to go in the history. I've got some testifiers here that go in the history, but I've been at that camp and observed what goes on there, and it's a great facility for our disabled veterans, and many of the cabins that are currently being constructed or have been constructed in the last 2 years are for the handicapped accessible. And but I'd like to introduce our first testifier. We have Lori Allness. She's the board member on the camp.
Welcome.
Hi, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I understand that...
Identify yourself.
Oh, Lori Allness. I'm a part of the Board of Directors for the Disabled Veterans Rest Camp.
Okay, continue, please.
I understand that the committee has been given a two-page summary on the program of the camp, and I'd like to highlight a few points. First, the camp has seen a surge of visitors. In the last 3 years alone, the amount of visitors to the camp has increased every year by an additional 2,000 visitors. This year, the camp is expecting over 12,000 visitors. This growth has required upgrading and expansion for our 85-year-old campground, along with its recreation and trail facilities. Second, many of those 10,000-plus visitors to the Disabled Veterans Rest Camp are from out of state, some staying the entire summer. This is a tremendous amount of veterans conjugating here in Minnesota, which is an economic benefit to the community and to Minnesota as a whole. Third, the Disabled Veterans Rest Camp is the only yellow ribbon camp in the United States. We worked very hard to submit our action plan that shows care for not only veterans but their families and friends as well, to be accepted by both the military and the state of Minnesota. We saw that Minnesota is the nation's leader for encouraging businesses, organizations, even churches and communities and counties to be yellow ribbon. And the Disabled Veterans Rest Camp recognized it was important to partner with these many private and public entities to care for our veterans. Lastly, because the camp is recognized by the public as being a successful reintegration venue for all veterans, we have had many organizations step forward to offer their assistance to upgrade and expand the camp. However, though we were given, let's say somebody's offering $150,000 of donated labor for a pavilion or for handicapped accessible cabins, the materials needed must be purchased by the camp. These facilities need to be finished, furnished, and even landscaped before they can safely be rented out. And to provide additional safety, a combined use shelter slash shower house needs to be constructed. For these reasons, we respectfully ask that a $500,000 matching grant be approved to continue this 85-year tradition of taking care of veterans and their families. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, our next testifier is Colonel Eric Allness with the Military Affairs. And as we can see here, we have a husband and wife team. I don't know who outranks who, but we'll let Colonel Allness take the next testifying.
Welcome, Colonel Allness.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Colonel Eric Allness, and I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota National Guard. And Representative Detmer, I think you know who's in charge. But also, since you're going to call me on the carpet, I'll call him on the carpet as well, too. He'll be retiring from military service here, not this weekend, but the next weekend, with well over 30 years of service and retiring as a Chief Warrant Officer for in the U.S. Army Reserve. And obviously, we respect and applaud him for his service to country over the decades. So.
Congratulations for your service, Representative Detmer. And notice I didn't gavel for silence on that one.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And I'm just going to talk to two aspects of this. And first of all is the yellow ribbon designation that Lori talked about a few minutes ago. And that's something that was developed over the last few years by the National Guard. And it's something that's not given out lightly. And we give it to cities and to colleges and to companies, in this case a camp, a nonprofit company, giving it to them. And they must demonstrate through a very thorough review process that they're going to do something beyond what we expect normal citizens and other people to do, that they're going to develop a work plan that's been vetted and showing that they're going to go the extra mile to help out the returning veterans and their families make it all the way home to be productive citizens. And really demonstrate that desire to help these returning veterans. And once the application and work plan is reviewed and approved, then the yellow ribbon designation is recognized by a proclamation by the governor. So again, this is something that is recognized as truly something going above and beyond what other companies and other organizations have done. And this yellow ribbon camp is one of 41 yellow ribbon entities within the state of Minnesota at this time. Now, we have more developing. We hope to welcome more on. But at this point, it's one of those leading entities within the state who's going on to do these great things. And I guess the importance of this display is that the camp is undergoing a thorough review and has demonstrated its commitment to preserving what was started in 1926 for a place for, you know, the people who are shell shock victims of World War I and continuing that into the 21st and beyond century. The second thing I want to just highlight just briefly is that we recognize the great work that this camp does. So we've given back to the camp as well. The last two summers we've had an engineer company. We call it a vertical engineer company, meaning they build things. We got electricians and carpenters and plumbers and so forth. And we saw that the value that this camp gives back to organizations, and since it's a nonprofit and there's already donated from like organized labor to help improve the camp, that we were able to have that go there and get some good training for these service members that adds value to this camp place. So we see the great value of it, and we have supported that through the work of our soldiers and airmen. That concludes my briefing, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, our final testifier, Mr. Chair and committee members, is Mr. L. Mitchell. Mr. Mitchell is the committee chair of the director of boards of the Disabled Veteran Rest Camp.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Mitchell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Except my name is Al Mitchell. I'm a combat disabled veteran from the Vietnam War. And I serve on the board for the Disabled Veterans Rest Camp of Big Marine. And presently I'm the president of that organization. We are trying very, very hard to take this camp from what is it started to be back in the 20s and the 30s as a place for shell shock World War One, World War Two veterans that came there. It actually had a hospital and a hotel and everything, and the cabins were built for the families to stay close to their soldiers, whoever came back, to help them get through the recovery process. And over the years, it's deteriorated and just kind of disappeared into the woods, and a bunch of veterans decided that they wanted to resurrect this again and get going, seeing it was still on the books, and we moved forward to it. Where it is today, we're trying to expand it and do the same thing we did when it was originally formed as a place for soldiers or airmen or veterans of all branches of service to be able to come out and do a small portion of recovery. We're not a hospital. We don't have doctors. We don't have nurses. But we do have veterans. We have veterans there that took the same oath as everybody else in the service, that they decided to do something for their country. And so it's a place for them. I'll share a little story with you. One time when the camp was opening, one of the veterans, him and I were sitting in our little favorite watering hole, the canteen we affectionately call it, that holds about 20 people in it. But it's should be on the historical society list because it's so old and it's still standing. But we were sitting there, and he said to me one day, he says, "You know, Al," he says, "it happened again." And I said, "What's that?" He says, "When I turned off the highway onto the dirt road coming into the camp," he says, "a feeling came over me and I started crying." And I says, "Gee," I says, It's really strange you said that, because I thought I was the only one that had that feeling when I turned off that road. And so that's what that camp brings. It brings a place that they're coming home, a place that they can sit and talk, be able to intermingle with other veterans and their families and everything, and find out that there's somebody that still has the same problem that I have, or no problem at all, but they can communicate to each other. So it's important that this camp moves forward. We have facilities that we want to put in for this camp, because the expansion, like Lori said, we have the number of veterans that are going through the camp now. It's grossly inadequate as far as what we'll be able to do. Even with people with trailers and everything, if you get like myself, who's disabled, and a few others and everything, we can't really climb in and out of those shower points in the RV safely and feel comfortable. So we go to the shower point. Well, that's, like I said, it's been there since 1922. So we need to replace those things. We need storm shelter for the people to go to. When the storms come in, there's no place to go for them to take shelter. So it's important that this gets expanded. And with your help, the state of Minnesota, to support our veterans and everything, to make this camp move forward, we greatly appreciate it. And so I thank you for the opportunity to do this, and I look forward to a good relationship, and that you will consider helping us expand this camp for veterans of Minnesota and throughout the country, because we get them from all over.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Detmer, anything else?
We're open for any questions that you might have of my testifiers.
Representative Dill?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer an amendment.
Yes, offer your amendment, Representative Dill.
Okay. I'm going to give you a little background on this amendment. This bill, when it was introduced, it was brought to my attention by Veterans on the Lake, which is located up in Fall Lake Township, just to the east of Ely and adjacent to the Boundary Waters, that they have the same difficulties as the Disabled Veterans Rest Camp on Big Marine Lake in Washington County, and that they wanted me to introduce legislation that would get them some money for the exact same purposes. And I believe there are only two of these types of camps in the state. One is the Disabled Veterans Rest Camp on Big Marine Lake, and the other one is the one that I'm referencing in Fall Lake. And I told them that I wasn't going to introduce a bill like this bill because it was an appropriation from the general fund. And, you know, the money from the general fund is competing with education and health care and all of those other things. But then when I came into committee and I saw that there was an amendment before us to change it from the general fund to the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, it seemed like this is something that I wanted to at least bring before the committee. So before I offer the amendment, I'd like to say that the Veterans on the Lake is a 501c3, which is the same as the Disabled Veterans Rest Camp that we're here looking at today. And I wanted to say there is a slight difference in the way that this is run, is the priority for their reservations, and this is brought to my attention, is that the first priority for all people that go to Veterans on the Lake, and this is located on a lake, they have pontoon boats that are accessible to veterans that are injured, severely injured. I've been there when the people had no arms or legs or both, and they take them out on pontoon boat rides over to the Boundary Waters and so on and so forth. But the first order of priority in taking a reservation at that camp is a disabled veteran. The second order of duty is, our preference is an active duty member. And then the third ranking is an able-bodied veteran, and then their families. And then the thing that's probably different than this organization that's before us is that they, Veterans on the Lake, also takes members of the public from the public that aren't veterans. They do that in the lowest priority to fill and to help with their cash flow so that they don't have open cabins from time to time, so that they can make ends meet, so they don't have to come here and ask for assistance often or go other places. My amendment will ask for $100,000, not $500,000, for the exact same purposes. So, Mr. Chairman, my amendment is on line 1.9 after the word county. Insert a comma and then add the following language. And a grant of $100,000 to Veterans on the Lake located on Fall Lake in Fall Lake Township, comma, St. Louis County. And that is my amendment. I prepared that and have given it to your administrator.
All right, thank you. Representative Detmer?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Dill, I know our camp also has reservations from a non-veteran, as long as they're sponsored by the veteran family. You know, we also do that too. My question is, we're at a matching grant of $500,000. So, are we then looking at a $600,000 matching grant here, or that would be my question? I know the Disabled Vets Vets Rest Camp on Big Marine Lake is asking for $500,000, and the only way they can draw on that is if they raise $100,000 increments of $100,000. If they don't, they don't get any of the grant.
Mr. Chairman
and Representative Dill.
Representative Detmer, yeah, that's correct. That's what the bill states, and frankly, they asked for $500,000 because they thought that they could find some kind of a match. I think that's a little bit aggressive, personally. So I lowered the amount at my own. In my own thinking process, to $100,000, and I understand that in order to get $100,000 in this bill, they'll have to raise $100,000. Right. I'm right. Confident they can do that. This is a very sophisticated location and organization that runs these, as are all these types of things, and very needy and worthy. And I have no doubt that if this were to become law and a part of the package, that they will be able to comply with all the provisions of this bill, House File 105.
It would not be our intention that it would negatively affect your proposal.
Okay. Mr. Chair, yeah, I would accept that amendment.
Thank you. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We heard a little bit of testimony from the presenters about the rest camp and the fact that it was from 1926. And I want to understand the connection to cultural heritage or history, and I guess 1926 at least is old, although it doesn't sound like the funds are going to be used for rehabilitating historic buildings. Maybe they are. But I wonder if Representative Dill, can you talk to the ancient order of the Fall Lake Camp?
The ancient order?
Good chairman.
Sounds like you have some type of lodge you're
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dill.
Representative Winkler, thank you for the question. It's not as old as the water they've recently found, which is older than mankind, in the Tower Sudan mine. I just learned that in another committee a day or two ago. But it does date back a long, long time. To the year exact, I do not know. It was formerly a U.S. Forest Service camp where they housed firefighters and people that worked in the boundary waters in the Superior National Forest, and the Forest Service closed the camp, and Congressman Oberstar, in his wisdom, understood that disabled veterans would have an excellent opportunity if this camp were to belong to a 501c3, that they would have an excellent opportunity to be able to at least brush up against the boundary waters, even though maybe they were disabled to the extent that they couldn't go in the boundary waters because of the limitations of no motors and portaging and things of that nature. So this dates back into, as I recall, and I got to be knowledgeable of those things in my teens, and as I recall, I went over to a meeting when this was being contemplated in the early 70s to make this Forest Service installation get it to a 501c3 and then make it a disabled veterans camp. But I think the ancient nature of what you're talking about is the fact that people go there that have served this country regardless of what war or conflict, and that they're disabled, and they did so in the honor and duty of defending the country, no different than these folks that are here before us today. And I thank for them for that, and we're here today because of that privilege that they've afforded us. And so that's my answer to your question, to the best of my ability.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think my question is for Representative Detmer. In the amendment that I moved, we put it in arts and cultural heritage, and I'm just wondering, wouldn't it be more appropriate in a parks grant? And I'm just wondering how it got to arts and cultural heritage. And this might be along the lines of Representative Winkler. It seems like the camp would be more appropriate to be in the parks area. Wondering if you could comment.
Representative Detmer?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative. Coming through the Chair Lanning's state government finance, they recommend that we bring it to this committee. And because of the we could say, cultural heritage of this camp dating back to the 20s.
Representative Detmer, this committee also has jurisdiction over the parks and trails, too.
That's right. Okay. Well,
and clean water.
You know, we are, Mr. Chair, we are definitely at the mercy of this committee, obviously. So,
well, Mr. Chair and
Representative McNamara.
Representative Detmer, I think it would be more appropriate, and Representative, you know what, I'm going to defer to Representative Murphy, I think, but I have concerns. I moved the amendment, Representative Detmer, without seeing it, and I apologize, but I think that maybe it would be more appropriate to be parks, or not necessarily identify, but I think parks seems to fit better myself. And Representative Murphy, I didn't know if you wanted to speak to this point.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, Representative Detmer, Representative Dill. I questioned that right away because if I remember Representative Kahn's statement at state governments, it was this belongs or this could go to the Legacy Committee. And I don't remember the conversation about which fund in the Legacy Committee. And the Legacy Committee has four funds: Outdoor Heritage, the Clean Water, Parks and Trails, and the Arts and Culture. And at the last meeting, Representative Cornish, I asked him why that bridge should be in arts and culture, and David Kelleher came up and testified about the historical aspect of the bridge and in American history, and that it's on the historical guide. But my question was going to be then of all of you, I have the impression that at these camps, these two camps now, that people go there to talk, as Mr. Mitchell said, but they go to fish, and to sit outdoors, and to walk on trails or go down some trails and just enjoy the outdoors with their buddies or new people that they meet. And maybe they go fishing that's near water. And they go out in boats up north, maybe more than down your place, but they have the total outdoor experience that you would get if you went to camp. And it seems to me that it fits much better in either the Clean Water Fund or the Parks and Trails Fund than it does in arts and culture.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. I think it would be useful for all of us to look at actually the language of the Constitution as we talk about this. And the language of the Constitution says money deposit in the Parks and Trails Fund may be spent only to support parks and trails of regional or statewide significance. And regional significance, when we did it, it is a term of art that is used in other statutes. So if you are going to move in this direction, I think you have to be able to demonstrate that this is a park of statewide or regional significance. So the statewide, obviously, is state parks. So is it of regional significance? And I think we should probably look at the statutory language, too, under Parks and Trails. I just don't recall it.
Okay. Representative Dill?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And am I right that the motion is to hold the bill over?
Yes.
And so that could probably be evaluated. I would suggest that this is actually an item not only of state significance, but national significance, because people, right. It is not limited to people from just Minnesota that go to this camp. People from other states come and go to this camp that are disabled because of the special opportunity that they have, at least in my instance, yeah. And I'm certain in their instance as well, that people come because it's the two facilities in our state that offer an opportunity for a disabled veteran, particularly extremely disabled veterans, that they can go out and enjoy these types of things. And I'm not really trying to figure out which fund it goes in. I'm more trying to figure out, I know that's an issue, but I'm more trying to figure out how to take care of these veterans and make sure that that they have a place to go. And so I guess that's my, if it's regional or state significance, I think it might even easily be go beyond that. But I'll just say it's statewide significance.
Okay, this is going to be laid over for possible inclusion. If there is a motion to direct it to a particular fund, I could take that. Otherwise, we may use our own discretion as to what entity is sent to.
Mr. Chair, I would like to
Representative Detmer?
Allow the committee to decide where these two camps best fit the statute. And you know, we fall under the same situation. We have veterans that come from all over, not just Minnesota, but from all over the area, the region.
Is there a motion from any member to change the category of funding?
Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Dill.
Oh, well, I have a question. I think I know the answer. On line 1.7, the appropriation, I think Representative Detmer touched on this a moment ago. My amendment did not increase the appropriation from 500 to 600,000. It just added another 100,000. So is it appropriate then to have an amendment possibly from the author that raises the 500 to 600,000?
Yes. Representative Detmer?
Mr. Chair and committee, that was my first question, if that's what we should do. So if we could amend on line 1.7 to 600,000, and knowing that 100,000 would be for the other disabled veterans camp.
Yes. Was that your motion, Representative Dill?
I'd rather have it come, Mr. Chair, from the author.
Mr. Chair.
But he can't move it.
Oh, I'm sorry. Then that is my motion. Yes. Sorry about
okay.
that. I forgot you weren't on the committee.
All right. So that's the motion then. Any objection to that? Seeing none, it passes. All right. This bill will be laid over for future possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Oh, if I'd only known.
House File 160, Representative Drazkowski.
This is from last year.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, this is a bill that Representative Anderson and I are working jointly on. We had a similar bill last year. We brought it before the same committee last year, and
we were going to put Mogi Lake on.
We had a discussion or an information only hearing in front of Representative Murphy's then committee. This is a bill look at restoration of both Lake Zumbro and Schmidt Lake. They're very similar in the fact that they have sedimentation, huge sedimentation problems. Mr. Chair, I'm going to turn the presentation over to Mr. Angerman, if that's okay.
Thank you. Welcome to committee. Identify yourself for the tape, please.
Bill Angerman. I'm a volunteer member of the Lake Zumbro Restoration Committee. Thank you, Chair and committee. I believe a pamphlet is being handed out. If not, I'll reference it. But what we're looking at is the dredging of Lake Zumbro to remove 1 million cubic yards of sediment to basically accomplish several items: to restore the lake, protect it, and preserve it through dredging the lake through to improve water quality by removing phosphorus from the lake, to restore recreational opportunity to a part of the lake where boating has been limited or lost, to preserve the hydropower opportunity that is on the lake. This lake was formed in 1919 when Rochester Public Utilities built a dam on the north end. That's a 3-megawatt facility. It is Rochester Public Utilities' only source of green power on the lake. The lake is about 650 acres, and about half of this area has been impacted by sedimentation. A little bit about that, some of the questions that we've received in the past is, why dredge a lake only to have it fill back in? You know, what other methods are being done to address that? Starting in 2002, the Lake Restoration Committee helped form the Zumbro Watershed Partnership Group, which is looking at the sediment reduction in the whole watershed. To date, their goal has been to reduce sediment to the lake by over 30%. And then with some of the work that's been done or accomplished on the lake, the rate of sedimentation has decreased by over 90% in the last 30 years. And a lot of that is attributed to the farm programs, the different things that really took place in the 1950s and 60s. So in essence, what has happened is the damage, so to speak, to the lake has already occurred. So by restoring this lake and, you know, improving water quality, preserving hydropower, recreation, etc., we do not feel that is a, you know, waste of time or effort. A couple other facts about the lake. Lake Zumbro, it has the highest population relative to lake area in all greater Minnesota. So why is that? Well, it's because we only have one lake in southeastern Minnesota. So we might be the lake of, land of 10,000 lakes, but we're the land of one lake in southeast Minnesota. So again, very important to us. Estimated peak summer usage at over 1,600 people per day are using Lake Zumbro. So again, a high usage and a real important to the region. The 1 million cubic yards that we're looking at for dredging, one of the first things that I asked when we first started coming to the Capitol was, is this project feasible? So the legislature did appropriate $175,000 in the 2008 bonding bill, of which that money was matched, $100,000 from our Rochester Public Utilities and $75,000 from in-kind donations and work by the residents around the lake. So that work was used for the preliminary engineering analysis, and the conclusion of that is that this project is feasible from an engineering perspective. The dredging methodology, disposal sites have been figured out, so the feasibility, has been completed, and that we feel this is a viable, feasible project that, again, will, you know, preserve the hydroelectric power, but also improve the water quality, fish habitat, and recreational opportunities on the lake.
Welcome, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for having us here today to talk about this issue. We come at it from a different perspective from the metro area, and I have with me two fellows. I've got Joe Scalzo, and I have Jamie Page from the Schmidt Lake area, and I'm going to turn it over to them.
Welcome. Identify yourself, please.
Hello, Chairman Erdahl. It's Joel Scalzo from Plymouth. I'm a volunteer board member for Schmidt Lake Improvement Association.
Excuse me.
I do apologize for acting nervous. It's been a while since I've presented in front of my junior high teacher.
Joey Scalzo.
Yes, it is.
And who taught you the most, everything you know about American history?
You did, Chairman Erdahl.
Thank you. Representative Anderson, you do know this may hurt your project. Continue. I can't say Mr. Scalzo. Continue, Joey.
Thank you, Chairman. Schmidt Lake is located in the western suburbs of the Twin Cities. It's in Plymouth. It's part of the Schmidt Lake Watershed Association, which flows into and is the head of the Shingle Creek Watershed Association. Our lake was developed, the first house was built on our lake in 1957. Most of the development of our lake was done in the 60s and the 70s. The association was formed in 1976 and consists of 58 homeowners that surround our lake. It's a fairly small lake of 36 acres. Our mission of our lake association is to improve the water quality and restore the natural balance of Schmidt Lake. Our association, as I mentioned, is consisted of 58 homes. Our association enjoys over in excess of 80% participation in our association, and our entire operating budget is funded by our homeowners. We're part of the Watershed Association, as I mentioned, which consists of 220 homes that flow directly into our lake, and as I mentioned before, we are the headwaters of Shingle Creek Watershed Association. Approximately 10 years ago, we repositioned our association to be more strategic in how we can achieve our mission of restoring the natural level of our lake. We went after three items, or identified three key items. One is to improve the water quality that is in our lake. Two is to remove the sediment and chemicals and debris and everything that has flowed into the lake over the past 50 years. And three is to improve the communication and education and hinder the water flow that goes into our lake currently. Because of the limited resources of our association, we felt that we could obtain most of our efforts through improving the water quality in our lake. We don't have the resources to be able to maintain any control over what's the sediment and the debris and also the runoff that flows into the lake. Our success over the past 10 years has been documented in a number of different ways. We have successfully eradicated northern Eurasian water milfoil in our lake. To my knowledge, this is the first lake in Minnesota that's been able to do that. We have reduced the amount of invasive species of curly pondweed in our lake to a 7% littoral surface area. This is another strong accomplishment that we've been applauded for our efforts through the DNR. Our water clarity has improved from an average of 21 inches of water clarity to in excess of 6.5 feet, which is pretty unusual for a lake within the 7-county metro area. The result of this has brought back our fishery and our natural wildlife to a much more natural balance. We now have eagles, owls, cranes, and fox as common neighbors within our neighborhood that weren't there 5 years ago. Here's where we need assistance in our plan. We don't have the resources to be able to manage the sediment that is in our lake that has been flowing freely into our lake since the area was developed back in the 50s and 60s and 70s before best management practices were implemented. There's a a copy of our lake map that I may have included. I'm not sure if you've received it yet. There are over 98 storm drains that flow directly into our lake unimpeded in our watershed area. This flows from 7 storm drains. The amount of sediment, chemicals, and residue and poison that flows into our lake is something that we are unable to control and manage currently through our own association. What we're looking to for is assistance not only from the city and the county and the state agencies, but through your help in being able to provide the tools required to remove the sediment that's in our lake and to help us with impeding the progress and the runoff that flows directly into the lake through a number of pest management practices that we feel are suitable for our lake. Our sediment is somewhat similar to what you would find in a Twin Cities lake. We call it sediment. I think most of us affectionately call it as muck. If you've ever been in one of the local lakes, it is a pretty nice substance. Our average sediment depth is about 22 inches in our lake. We have one area that has sediment depth of in excess of 7 feet. This is accumulated over the years and is continuing to accumulate at an accelerated rate to a point where our progress that we've made over the past 5 years will soon be diminished based on the challenges that we see with things that we are not able to manage as our own association. We're working on ways and looking at ways of continuing to improve what we can do as a lake association and would want to stay actively involved with the city, the county, the Shingle Creek Watershed Association, and the state agencies in order to be able to restore our lake to a natural balance. In this other document that I provided, it shows some of the activities that we've used and the activities that we've done as a lake association that we'll continue to do. It also goes in more details about the requests of what we're looking for in assistance in areas that we are not able to provide on our own and feel that through best management practices we can achieve our goal of restoring Schmidt Lake back to a natural and healthy lake in the Twin Cities. Thank you.
Thank you. Learned a lot of big words in 7th grade. Very good.
Mr. Chair.
Sorry. Representative Wilgenius.
Are you ready for questions or not?
Are you ready for...
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Representative Wisconsin.
Just a couple other things, if I could mention. The Lake Zumbro project is actually 9 years in the works. The volunteers, there's about 200 members in the Lake Zumbro Improvement Association. There's about 350 owners around the lake. As Mr. Angerman mentioned, it's the only lake in southeast Minnesota. It's very regionally significant within about 10 or 15 minutes of Rochester. And as he mentioned, about 1,600 users or more per day. There are parts of the lake, Mr. Chair, that are sedimented so that the water depth at this point is about a half a foot, 6 feet or 6 inches deep, and in areas where it was 10 or 20 feet deep several decades ago.
Thank you. Representative Wilgenius.
Thank you. Same question for both lakes. In Lake Zumbro, I think what I heard is you have now controlled 90% of the problem that was coming into your lake, and you have 10% left. What are your plans for controlling that 10%?
Bill Angerman, thank you, Chair.
Mr. Angerman.
The plans for that are to continue to work in the watershed. So that would be programs as far as farming practices, continued work on waterways, continued work with the City of Rochester on their stormwater management program. So basically, as you mentioned, that last 10%, we're still plugging away, working on that, working with the MPC, other state agencies to continue to reduce that. But we feel that this project, because the sediment has been reduced so much, that it is now a sustainable project.
Representative Wagenius.
Yeah, well, the 10% coming in constantly just doesn't work. So the question I would have to follow up is, when would you, what's your timeline for finishing getting that the 10% isn't coming into your lake?
Mr. Angerman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. At some point, some sedimentation is unavoidable for farming practices, et cetera. We have estimated that at the reduced sedimentation rate, it would be another 40 years to basically accumulate the 1 million yards to pull that out. And at that point, a project like this is much more feasible to maintain. That once you have the big chunk of sediment out, it's on an annual basis you can remove the smaller amounts, but it's just not feasible to from a maintenance perspective to catch up to be able to undo 90 years or 100 years of sedimentation.
Representative Wagenius.
Okay, I get that. What I don't get is the timeline where you're going to get the other 10% done. So that was. It seems that there isn't a timeline for that.
Mr. Angerman.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. I guess the timeline is that those are ongoing items that are being worked at by other entities besides the Lake Association.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Similarly, for the Schmidt Lake, you're asking us for money to restore a lake, but telling us, on the other hand, that sediment is coming in rapidly. So that seems like a conflict. You can't restore a lake where sediment is rapidly accelerating. So the question is the same for Lake Zumbro. How is it? What's the plan of action for
Mr. Skills?
If we were to get money to restore the lake, that it wouldn't have to be turned around and be restored all over again. I mean, restore doesn't work. You're not restoring if it's...
Mr. Chairman, representatives, our lake is a little unique in the fact that it's fairly small. Our watershed area is controlled. It's a spring-fed lake. What we're looking at with this recommendation would be to hinder and impede most of the runoff that flows into the lake and the amount of sediment that has accumulated over the last 50 years. Through our past activities in the last 5 years, we've been able to prove that we can get the water quality into a reasonable, sustainable level. And there will be some natural restoration that the lake, a healthy lake, will be able to do in reducing sediment naturally. Through its natural process of turning the lake over. There are certain sediments that are inorganic that are flowing into the lake, that are flowing into the lake now that we need to stop, and that's been our request through this. The organic material that's flowing into the lake, if it is a healthy lake and sustainable lake, should be able to maintain, I think what you were mentioning, a good portion of that sediment, phosphorus, and levels that come into the lake that are organic, that the lake would be able to manage and maintain much easier. That's our plan in being able to manage this over the next few years.
Representative Wagenius?
Well, final question. For the last 2 years, Bowser, and this is money for Bowser, has had a competitive grants, put out proposals for competitive grants. Did you all apply for the competitive grants process?
Heads don't register, please.
Yes, it's our understanding that yes, we have applied for those grants.
And Zumbro?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Angerman.
Representative, We have not applied specifically for a Bowser grant, but we've applied for other grants through the LCCMR and some of the other funding sources that have been made available to us.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wondered for the testifiers on behalf of Schmidt Lake, you may have mentioned it and I missed it, but is there public access to that lake? And if so, could you describe, you know, how much, et cetera? Thank you.
Mr. Scalzo.
Mr. Chairman and representatives, there is a public access on the west side of the lake along Larch Lane. It was something that the Lake Association partnered with the City of Plymouth approximately 8 years ago to improve. Unfortunately, right now, it's a main cause of part of the sediment flow that we're seeing, and we're working with the city to resolve that issue. But it is a public access. What we've been able to see is a significant improvement in usage through the community, not only through the public landing, but also through the city park on the northeast corner of the lake. There's a significant amount of our community that is using our lake as it's improving.
Right. Thank you. At this point, could you finish up, then we're going to lay it over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Just real quickly, I was talking with Mr. Ingerman, Representative Wagenius. I know that the Lake Zumbro Group has applied several times, most recently with the Lessard Outdoor Heritage Council in their most recent round. And Mr. Ingerman mentioned 8 different times, including DNR and other types of granting approaches. So, members, these two projects are very similar in the fact that we're looking at doing dredging projects that will restore directly, in my opinion, with the spirit of the constitutional amendment that was passed by the voters in 2008 to restore a resource. It's a very important regional resource for southeast Minnesota. Again, the only lake in the area, really a big resource for us that these funds would go very well towards enhancing the ability for southeast Minnesotans to use the outdoors.
Thank you. At this point, we'll lay this over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Next, we'll have Dan Larson of the Greater Minnesota Coalition of Parks and Trails. And I'll say this, for Mr. Larson, take about 10 minutes, and then we're going to kind of shift into high gear if we can, and about 5 minutes each the rest of the way, and I'm hopeful we can be done around 5 o'clock. So welcome. Welcome, Mr. Larson.
Madam Chair and members.
Thank you.
Dan Larson, Greater Minnesota Regional Park and Trail Coalition, pleased to introduce this newly formed organization to this committee. And my job today is to introduce the presenters. We've got a good group of Greater Minnesota Park and Trail directors here to walk you through a presentation that we think you'll find informative, and we hope you'll have some good questions at the end of the presentation, because we've got the people here who can answer them. So let me introduce to you Chuck Woken, the Stearns County Park Director at the far end, Barry Wendorf, who will be doing the presentation itself, and Madam Chair and members, the Greater Minnesota Park and Trail Coalition Chair, Marsha Larson, who is from Bemidji, the City of Bemidji Park and Trail Directors, and if I didn't mention it, Barry Wendorf is the Isanti County Park Director. So, Marcia, why don't I turn it over to you, and thank you again, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Marcia Larson, the Parks and Recreation Director for the City of Bemidji. First, I want to take the opportunity to thank you for giving us the opportunity to introduce our organization. which is the Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails Coalition, as well as our goal to create a parks and trails system that will truly be a legacy for Minnesota. As a chair, it's truly a privilege to be here and talk to you about the needs of Greater Minnesota and the truly dedicated parks and trails providers and advocates that are our members. So who is the coalition and why are we here besides the fact that we're very passionate people about parks and trails, and why is there a need for our organization? Our membership represents over 75 cities and counties from across Minnesota. We have come together to form an organization that will speak with a loud, clear voice in securing resources for parks and trails in Greater Minnesota. Together, our membership administers 128 regional parks, which is approximately 41,474 acres. We also administer 35 regional trails, which is approximately 489 miles. This is according to the University of Minnesota, which has been conducting the parks and trails inventory throughout the state. As Barry is going to talk about in a few seconds, is basically we are in our infancy state. Greater Minnesota is working hard to produce parks and trails and access for people so we can have connections to the outdoors. Our mission statement, which is up on the screen here, basically trying to improve the quality of life for the citizens of Minnesota, kind of underscores the importance of improving our parks and trails in Greater Minnesota. We want close to home access. We want to build parks and trails that create connections and opportunities, knowing that 67% of all outdoor recreation is happening within 30 minutes of our homes. It is vital for us to get those connections, to get people to have the positive experience in our parks and trails. Again, we look at kind of appreciating the state of Minnesota and the natural resources that we have. We recognize the great works that the visionaries of the metropolitan area or region have done in planning their parks and trails. They have created a cohesive system throughout the seven-county metro area. Our goal is to model the Greater Minnesota Parks and Trails system after that parks and trails system that works so well in a metropolitan area. What we are looking for is a balanced approach to parks and trail legacy funding to provide those vital connections to people and the outdoors throughout the state of Minnesota. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Barry, who from Asante County, who's going to talk a little bit about the details of what our group or our organization would like to see happen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Barry Wendorf, Isani County Parks Director and representing the Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails Coalition. As Marcia stated, the Metro Regional Parks and Trails are made up of multiple jurisdictions supported by the Met Council. With this support, they're able to create master plans for the entire metro area, which currently go out to 2030. Also, they have the ability to conduct visitor surveys that assist them in their planning efforts with this. The possibilities of expanding the regional parks and trail system statewide are historically been limited by resources necessary to carry out a vision. Our vision is to create an integrated system statewide, providing every Minnesotan the opportunity to access the outdoors. The maps in front of you show the current regional parks and state parks throughout the state of Minnesota on the left-hand side. The red dots are state parks, while the green parks are representative of regional parks, both metro and non-metro. The right-hand slide shows a picture of trails, and the map does show proposed trails and current trails. This is a map inventory conducted by the Central Changing Landscape. And the orange trails on the map are future trails, which would need future funding. The red trails are state trails, and the purple trails are regional trails or state significance. Over the past 8 years, the Regional Park Grant Program has funded 20 projects totaling $7.8 million, averaging under $1 million a year for the entire state. A recent survey by the Coalition estimated that Greater Minnesota has at least $33 million in grant needs over the next 4 years for regional park and trail projects. Funding these projects would create over 700 jobs throughout the state for construction crews, surveyors, architects, marketing, and park staff. Investments in regional park and trail facilities create close-to-home outdoor recreation opportunities that are vital to Greater Minnesota communities. The grants program also leverages local funding and resources, including perpetual maintenance of parks and trails. These projects also provide riparian protection, wildlife habitat, along with access to lakes and streams, all vital or all highly valued by Minnesotans, both urban and rural areas. The 25-year plan conducted by the DNR with statewide citizen input states that the Greater Minnesota system plays a major role in providing park experiences in Greater Minnesota. It shares our vision to build an interconnected system with parks and trails that are accessible to all Minnesotans. It calls for distributing legacy funds in a manner that will be viewed by the citizens of Minnesota as reasonable. Over time, achieving at least a reasonable degree of equity of funding among parks and trails of state and regional significance. It also states not to establish a distribution formula for the Parks and Trails Legacy Fund. Greater Minnesota regional park and trail providers were awarded $3.5 million through a statewide park and trail grant program in 2010, while grants requests totaled $18.9 million. This slide also represents 43% that was designated for metro regional park and trails, also 43% designated for state park and trails, and 6% designated for a statewide regional park program, a 6% for a regional statewide trail program, and another 2% for a solar grant program available to metro and non-metro parks. Metro regional park and trail projects that meet funding eligibility in their 2030 plan are funded by their 42% appropriation. Projects that do not meet the eligibility in the 2030 plan are submitted to the statewide grants program, which we also have the possibility of applying for. The governor's recommendation for the coming year is 42%, 42%, and 16% split. This is a continuation of the past year's allocations. Greater Minnesota was not included in the recommendation, therefore, needs were defined by the state and metro providers. The governor's recommendation of 42%, 42%, 16% demonstrates the need for our coalition, and it does not provide the needs for Greater Minnesota. The Park and Trail Legacy Plan suggests helping create a Greater Minnesota Regional Park and Trail Network. The Greater Minnesota Network is new and needs establishment money. There is no way to compare us in our infancy to the mature metro system that took more than a century to build. And the next following slides will help illustrate the current comparison. This is a Greater Minnesota Regional Park and Trail system today with our 14% shared statewide park and trail grant program, defined by numbers accumulated by the mature metro park system. By comparison, this is how we perceive the strong and mature metro park system with their well-established parks and trails and campgrounds. We would like to provide this type of opportunity at regional parks outside of the metro area, providing quality outdoor recreation for all Minnesotans. The Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails Coalition asks the legislator to recognize the role that Greater Minnesota fills in acquiring, developing, and maintaining regional parks and trails, and make Greater Minnesota jurisdictions an equal partner with state parks and metro parks in allocations from the Park and Trail Legacy Fund. With that, I'll turn it over to Chuck Wolken.
Mr.
Chuck Wilkins, Stearns County Park Director, and a member of the Legacy Park and Trail Planning Committee. The governor's recommendation of 42% exclusively to DNR, 42% exclusively to Metro Parks, and then 16% shared for a statewide grant program doesn't work for our membership. Where did the governor's current budget numbers come from? Basically, suggestions from state agencies. Was the Greater Minnesota Regional Park and Trail Coalition consulted about what would be a fair and equitable number for the use of the park and trail funds? Though the members from Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails were involved in every step of the planning process over the last 18 months, work groups and on steering committees, there was no question or no consultation with Greater Minnesota about what would be a good formula to use. We look at our own membership survey and we see $33 million of potential grant needs out there in the next 4 years. Why are Metro jurisdictions allowed to apply to the statewide program when Metro already receives its own exclusive allocation? We don't have any good answer for that. We find it unacceptable in Greater Minnesota. We're looking for equal and exclusive treatment, the same as Metro and State Parks. We'd be glad to field any questions that you may have, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Wiginius.
Thank you. I hear the emphasis on the word equity and equal. So as we're describing that, do you mean equity in dollars per person or that is served, or do you mean equity in acreage per person that is served?
Mr. Wilkin.
Mr. Chair, representatives, at this point we're looking at an equal funding share between the state parks, Metro Parks, and Greater Minnesota.
Representative Wiginius.
So you're not considering the number of people served, so there's no equity per person, or are you in favor of a per person type formula?
Mr. Wilkin.
Now, Mr. Chair, representatives, we have no solution as to the standards that are used. I know locally in Stearns County we use the same standard for regional parks per 1,000 population that the Metro does, and we fall far short of the 25 acres per 1,000 population within our particular county. We don't have any strategy on that statewide.
Representative Guineas?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At some point it would be helpful to have the figures, and I think they are in that plan, about the per person in various regions and the per acreage in various regions.
Okay, thank you. Yes.
Chair Erdahl, representatives. As we stated in our presentation, we are, as a network, in our infancy stages. So it is difficult for us to get the same numbers that come out of the Metro Park system because they are well established. When they first created their system, Horace Cleveland, back in 1883, we're in that stage. I mean, I'm sure their visitation numbers were not the best then, and their population was 200,000 at that point. So that's where we're basing our information out of, is a system in our infancy.
Representative Dill.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure who can give the answer to this question, but a moment ago the testifier said something about or alluded to the fact that the Metro Parks can apply to the other components of this of the split.
Yes.
Yet they get one of the largest allocations, or at least equal allocation to the department, as I understand. Is that true? And I guess I was not aware of that.
Yes, that's true.
Okay, so, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Dill.
Why would, if we split this out, I'd like to understand the history of why it was decided that Metro Parks could go after the money that went to other
areas. I don't have an understanding of that. I'm sorry that I don't understand that. It's my first time on this committee, and so.
Is there someone from the DNR, or no, there isn't. Is anyone that can answer that question, the history of why this decision is made? Apparently we'll have to work on that unless Representative Wagenia has an answer, sorry.
Thank you. I think what we'll have to discuss is a couple of things like the metro parks are regional parks. They're not state parks as in the DNR system. They are regional parks. But not all parks in, say, Minneapolis are regional parks. I have a park up the street from where I live. It would not be eligible for those funds because it's a local park, not a regional park. So I think it's the statutory language of regional significance would be one thing. But I think it's, we're going to have some good testimony on per person, not only usage, but how much acreage there is per person in the various systems so that we can see what equity is.
I'm sure that the DNR has the answers to those questions. We'll have to get them from them. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I have a simpler way of looking at equity, which is that if you sort of figured that the total legacy funding for parks went half in the seven-county metro and half outside, if you combine all funds, that would be one measure of equity. I have Department of Revenue statistics that show that the metro area, the seven-county metro area, generates about 64% of the total pool of legacy funds. So even if it was split 50-50 between metro and Greater Minnesota, including the DNR, that would, it'd be hard to argue that Greater Minnesota doesn't get an equal or fair share in looking at that. So I wonder just about total dollars. I mean, I know that we have two state parks in the seven-county metro area, and all the others are in Greater Minnesota. So I don't look at this as a third, a third, a third. I look at this as seven-county metro and Greater Minnesota. And I don't expect you to have the numbers, but as we evaluate it, I would want to look at the actual dollars out and how we expect that to happen.
Representative Dill.
Okay, well, I guess I don't expect an answer, but what I would like to know is the definition of metro parks then. Is that the metro counties? Is that the Met Council's jurisdiction? I don't know that anybody can answer it at this very second, and maybe they can, but something that would be of interest to me as a member. So that I understand this more, because honestly, I'm new on the committee and I just don't know.
Thank you, Representative Dill. Mr. Wilkin, outside the 7th County metro area, isn't that what you're doing?
That's what we're looking at. The definition that was used by the DNR for Greater Minnesota, well, for regional parks, for the grant program is what we have used as a definition for parks, for our coalition. Regarding the usage in state parks, we look at 45%. I think the DNR studies show that 45% of the usage of the state parks occurs from members and citizens of the Metro Council, 17% from Greater Minnesota. And so there's a large tourism component that's involved with the state park system. We look at it as everybody's system. That system's a great system. The Metro system's a great system. But without any sort of equal funding for Greater Minnesota, we will have a difficult time providing for access to our citizens as well.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wondered, what would be the kind of organizational oversight? What are you envisioning? Is there, for example, actually, I even wondered who would Governor Dayton have approached if he had wanted to find out what outstate wanted to do?
Mr. Wilkin.
Mr. Chair, representatives, the coalition has been around for about a year. Four of the members have been on the steering committee for the Legacy Park and Trail Plan. So there has been a lot of activity with DNR over the last 18 months. A lot of activity from Greater Minnesota Regional Park and Trail providers to help with the inventory that the U of M was also providing.
Thank you. I have a follow-up. I wondered, one thing I'm familiar with is that the Metro Park has a 20-year, 30-year plan. I know that there are kind of mechanisms in place for distributing money. I realize that you're in your infancy, as you've said. I come from the private sector, and I just kind of wondered, what's your business plan? How are you going to execute? What's the roadmap?
Mr. Walton.
Mr. Chair, representatives, right now the only vehicle we have for trying to build out the Greater Minnesota system is through the statewide grant program. As was mentioned earlier, less than $1 million per year would go to all of Greater Minnesota for regional parks. We've pretty much been tied to that grant program, and that's one of the things that makes it more difficult for us to look at sharing what little resources have been given to Greater Minnesota, is that they also need to be shared with Metro, which also has a 42% or a large allocation exclusive of access by Greater Minnesota.
I have just a follow-up comment, which is that I think of myself almost as an investor on behalf of taxpayers, and I'd kind of want to see a little bit more in the shape of what your plan is. I hear what you're asking for, but I'd like to see how you want to spend that money, what the oversight is, and so on.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and representatives, we believe that the 25-year plan that was conducted by the Minnesota DNR also lays out areas that funding would go to. They currently administer the statewide grants program and would continue to administer that grant program. The maps that I showed previously show spots where trails are needed and where parks are not serving local communities. So those would be the areas that funding would go towards.
Okay. Thank you. We'll move on unless you have any final comments. Mm-hmm. That's it.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay, at this point, we'll now shift into high gear. Yeah, this is the lightning round. What I'd like basically is a quick explanation of what you plan to do with legacy funding in the next year and how much you want. So we are just going to make one little switch in the agenda, and that's in deference to the Representative Winkler. We're going to move the Perpich Center up. So number one on your list, the Perpich Center. And we'll do the minutes quick. Is there a motion, Representative Winkler, the 23rd?
Mr. Chair, I move the minutes of February 23rd.
In 5 minutes there were. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes have passed. Welcome. Please identify yourselves and let us know about the Perpich Center.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm so pleased to be here this afternoon. My name is Sue Mackert. I'm Executive Director of the Perpich Center for Arts Education, and I'm very pleased and proud to introduce Dr. Pamela Paulson, who is our Senior Policy Director. And in recognition of the time that you would like to be over by five, I'm going to reduce my marks rather significantly. That's why I carry a red pen.
Oh, thank you. No, I'm just kidding. You can keep going.
It's not five yet. It's not yet. Very briefly, as I will remind you that the Perpich Center for Arts Education received $1 million from the legacy by the legislature for our investment over the past 2 years, and we're seeking $2.5 million. And in very quick bullets, I'll tell you why. First of all, we consider it a significant investment, and we take that responsibility seriously on our part. It's an investment in education and in our youth. It's sustainability. The purpose of our project, and Dr. Paulson will explain what we have been doing and what we're going to do, is all about sustainability. Systemic issues. In education, we hear an awful lot about achievement, and what we are here to do is to address the systemic issues that affect academic achievement. It's of great value. we throw numbers around. We look at what we're doing. We had indicated before when we took this project on that we would leverage our monies to bring the best out to our schools and teachers and districts. So we are delivering a program right now that is that costs under $231. I'm sorry, $2.31 per student. We think that's pretty good, but we know we can do better. It's profitable. We're talking about education of young people. We're talking about making a difference for their future. The return on investment is through academic achievement that we are tracking, that will be measurable, that is part of our project. And because I only have a half a second left, I'll just say we're really good. We're very good at what we do in delivering arts education, and we expect that through our program we leave a significant legacy. So with that, I will reintroduce Dr. Pamela Paulson, who will talk about our project.
Dr. Paulson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Pam Paulson, and I serve as Senior Policy Director at the Perkert Center for Arts Education. I hope each of you have this handout in front of you.
Great.
It is a handout about the Perkert Center Arts Integration Project, and it relates to the plan, which is kind of the narrative, and at the last page is the budget. I think the thing that you really need to keep in mind about this particular plan is the point is building the capacity of the teachers in this region so that they not only impact the achievement of their current students, but a lot of students in the future that these same teachers will have an opportunity to teach. The research tells us that good professional development has to be ongoing, not a one-shot deal, connected to the real work of the classroom, and it is involving collaboration of teachers. So if you look at the top of your handout, you'll see a map that has the 11 ECSUs, the Educational Cooperative Service Units. The one that's kind of brownish is the one that we're currently working in with our current legacy funds. That's Region 4. You look in the middle of that page, you'll see our five goals are listed, and they are matched up with some measures, including measures for student achievement, using standardized test scores as well as looking at the standards and also non-academic factors that lead to success like absentee rates and student engagement. If you go down to the bottom of the page, it starts to talk about what program we would envision for this additional money. It includes expanding the project to two new regions, one in the northern part of the state and one in the southern part of the state. In addition, we would like to keep working with the Lakes Country region because after spending some time with them, we expect them to become independent and able to function with some new skills and knowledge that will allow them to continue doing this work even after the legacy funds are no longer serving that particular region. The third thing is an online component for learning. And we envision some new courses that teachers that aren't even involved in this project could have access to, as well as strong documentation of this project. In the middle of the second page, you see the timeline. And on the last page, very colorful page, you see the budget. The budget tracks along this very same thing that I just said, a southern region, a northern region, continuing the Lakes Country region, new technology resources, documentation and accountability, and an administrative cost of 2.5%, totaling just about $2.5 million.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. 5 minutes, very good. Do you have a comment, Representative Winkler?
Just one, Mr. Chair. In the state constitution, it says that we're supposed to be doing this for arts education, and the Perkert Center is a state agency whose sole mission is arts education in Minnesota.
Thank you. This request will be set aside for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Libraries. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Mark Ranum. I'm here on behalf of Regional Public Library Systems in the state of Minnesota. And I feel special today in that today is Library Legislative Day, and we have library supporters from around the state in the room, and if you could raise your hands and let people know that you're here. Library folks are in the Capitol today, in the buildings. I'm hoping you're all having a chance to get a visit with your local library supporters.
Does this mean that we're going to be lonely here as soon as you're done?
I think so.
I will try to convince them to stay, Mr. Chair, but I am not sure I will do a good job. So, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, you have in front of you a handout that explains our request for the next biennium of a total of $10 million over the biennium. Over the last biennium, the current biennium, regional libraries were entrusted with $8.5 million. With that money, we have provided over 4,000 programs so far. We've had 280,000 attendees, and we have done this through 1,200 partnerships, local partnerships, regional partnerships, and statewide partnerships. In particular, I want to thank our friends at the Minnesota Historical Society Libraries, partner with them in a couple of tremendously active statewide programs, and we expect to continue to do so. Libraries are a priority for Minnesotans. In most communities who have a library, especially smaller communities, the library really is the center for arts, culture, and history in that town. We actually just this past week lost one of our treasures, our Cosmos Library, if you have not heard, burned to the ground, actually into the basement. But we expect that library to come back. Looking up at our Pioneerland friends. We expect that library
that
to come back.
That was in my district, by the way.
As a community would not want to be without a library once you've had one. These locations, this network of 360 public libraries around the state, provide a unique opportunity for legacy funds and legacy programs. No other organization in the state has the number of locations, the number of people who are experts in programming, and the number of people who have friends groups, partners, and other community organizations who want to provide these kind of activities. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to take questions, or Elaine Keith from Capitol Hill Associates, who represents the Minnesota Library community, would be happy to accept questions as well.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Elaine Keith, representing the Minnesota Library Association, and I won't add to what Mr. Ranum said. I'm just here to help answer any questions.
Representative Dill?
The Chairman, I don't have a question. I need to make a comment about the library system. From my home community, the closest regional library is 70 miles one way. And my wife, after her four-year education, then went back to school to be a teacher, and she literally wore the wheels off of a Dodge minivan going to the library to study, because we didn't have internet in our community at that time. And we also have an outreach through the Arrowhead Library System that comes up to Orr, which is 30 miles, 2 miles by boat from our house, and then 30 miles by car. So I just have to impress upon people that there are people in Minnesota that don't have access like most people have access, and how important this is for people to advance themselves and have these resources. Now, I'll grant you that the internet, we now have 1 meg of internet, which is still horse and buggy compared to most communities, but it is vitally important if we are going to work our way out of the wilderness. And my wife lives in a wilderness, and she worked her way out of it. So thank you very much for your work, and I'd encourage this committee to strongly support the library system.
Thank you. Representative Dill, do you feel you've worked yourself out of the wilderness yet?
Mr. Chairman, when I come here, I think I'm in the wilderness.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's go fishing. Sure, we're just getting good, by the way. Mr. Holm, Welcome, Mr. Holm. And who is the who taught you everything you know about American history?
Let's see. I think I had one American history teacher, and that would be yourself, Mr. Erdahl. Yes.
This is alumni day for me.
I appreciate it all. I appreciate it all.
Welcome, Mr. Holm.
Thank you.
Make your presentation, please.
Okay. Mr. Chair, representatives, my name is Joe Holm. I'm the statewide director for Let's Go Fishing in Minnesota. And you were all, I think, given a handout. If you do have it, I'd like to make reference through that with our limited amount of time. Starting right out on this, Let's Go Fishing is a statewide organization, as you can see with the map. What we're proposing is $137,500 funding from the Cultural Heritage Fund. Let's Go Fishing is a no-charge. We offer no-charge fishing trips 6 days a week during the open water, spring, summer, and fall, until the winter of 2012, which it will also be ice fishing. We serve seniors, kids, and military veterans. The whole goal is passing the Minnesota's fishing tradition on to future generations. When we were looking at appropriate places of funding, we went to the research department and looked at the Cultural Heritage Fund response that they had given, that a representative here had asked, and it stated that, in part, that stating that culture is all about our way of life, the way we live, the things we treasure, our values. And we went to the Minnesota Constitution, Article 11, Section 15, which states, money from the Cultural Heritage Fund shall be spent in part to preserve Minnesota's history and cultural heritage. So the first question becomes, is fishing a part of Minnesota's history and cultural heritage? We think it is, and here's a few examples. When you talk about Minnesota, you look at the land of 10,000 lakes. You see on the bottom of that page, front page of Time magazine, a picture of Governor Wendell Anderson on the Time magazine cover. You look at the Minnesota Governor's fishing opener, a tradition for 63 years. Over 1 million anglers expected to take part in Saturday's fishing opener, a unique Minnesota holiday. We could give countless examples of fishing being a part of who we are and how we live in Minnesota. However, that would be overstating the obvious. Simply put, fishing is a part of Minnesota culture. On the next page, and just sharing about Let's Go Fishing, we are a nonprofit 501c3 organization with a simple mission of enriching people's lives through fishing and boating experience. They do this by providing no-charge fishing and boating experiences to seniors, kids, and military veterans. This program makes a rich contribution to the cultural heritage of the state of Minnesota. On there you can see the numbers that Let's Go Fishing has produced in terms of serving individuals. This last year, we served 14,305 individuals in 2010, and it's projected to be serving 20,000 now that we're including the intergenerational program. Also, by the year 2015, we'll be at 50,000 individuals per year. This could not be made possible without the volunteers, which in 2010 were 1,547 volunteers and will be projected right at 2,325 volunteers in 2011, 1,500 in 2010. The importance to this to people all across the state of Minnesota has just been critical on this program. The state of Minnesota numbers show that in 15 years we'll have more people 65 and older than all of our kids K through 12 combined. What Let's Go Fishing looks at that in terms of, number one, is the cultural heritage that our seniors have had for so long, and without a program like this that cannot continue, and also with our youth And, Mr. Chair, at this point, I'd like to refer over to Mike Frisch, our Youth Program Director.
About a minute, please.
Okay. Mr. Chair, committee members, I am Mike Frisch. I'm the Youth and Intergenerational Program Director for Let's Go Fishing. And on that next sheet, again, we have a definition of cultural heritage, and it talks about past generations maintaining in the present and then bestowed for the benefit of future generations. As Joe said, we believe that fishing is a rich part of Minnesota culture. Our program allows people to continue that tradition. We've defined a lifelong angler as someone who learns to fish from someone in a previous generation. If that opportunity is not possible, maybe their parents don't fish, it's a single parent situation, whatever it might be, this is where our Let's Go Fishing Youth program comes in that we are taking kids out on the water 6 days a week and also educating them about fishing. So we are unique in that we have kids out every day of the week during the open water. B, the individual continues to fish throughout adulthood in formative years on their own. And then we think another critical link that we do is in C, a senior adult continues to fish until he or she maybe doesn't have the means, the health, mobility, whatever it might be. And that's where Let's Go Fishing also comes into play, in that we take seniors out to continue a tradition and a culture that they've engaged in their entire lives and maybe no longer have the ability to do that. And then lastly, passing on the heritage, our unique intergenerational program is where we pair seniors with kids in a mentoring situation where not only do they pass on the fishing tradition, but they also pass on life experiences and the wisdom that seniors have garnished from a lifetime of Minnesota experiences. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Holm, what is your request? How much?
$137,500.
All right. Thank you. It will be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. The Science Museum of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Dr. Eric Jolly, president of the Science Museum of Minnesota. I am delighted to be here today to thank you for the past support that we have had through the legacy funding and to tell you how we plan to continue to integrate that into our 103-year-old tradition of using artifacts and stories to serve the people of Minnesota. We will, if granted the $1 million over the two-year biennium, continue the four primary streams of work that we began with the legacy dollars. First and most important to us is the acquisition of the treasures of the state of Minnesota. Just over 2 years ago, we learned that artifacts which the Science Museum had cared for more than 40 years, a part of the history and tradition of our settlements, of all of our peoples, the story of our native people and our new immigrants of nearly 140 years ago. Now, they came together through these artifacts that were held in trust by many different institutions, including Shattuck St. Mary's, and which were preserved in the Science Museum's vaults, that they were up for sale and possibly going to leave Minnesota and, in fact, leave our continental 48 states. And the Science Museum worked very hard with a number of other organizations and was able to, with legacy dollars, begin the acquisition and continued preservation of these artifacts. We plan to maintain that commitment and finish our acquisition of these artifacts and maintain the history of Bishop Whipple, the Episcopal Church, and the Native traditions that they have and stories that they have told. In addition to our acquisition, we will continue to expand our new program called Suitcase Science. Suitcase Science takes advantage of our theater program, the oldest science theater in the United States, the legacy of August Wilson, a great Minnesotan author, is found in the Science Museum's Suitcase Science programs that bring science exhibitions into community centers for seniors and into libraries across the state, taking an artifact and telling a story and making it come to life, and then leaving behind both the story, a storybook, and the artifacts so that people learn the science of telling a story through their own culture, their own artifacts, and their own tradition. We will continue suitcase science in our community-based centers, our senior centers, our libraries, and with our schools across the state. We spent a small portion of our dollars from Legacy to engage schools in ways that we thought would be most useful to them, and we looked at developing protocols for interactive video conferencing. We found out that we weren't listening well enough to what schools really were ready to take advantage of. And in so doing, the schools have offered us a dozen new ways to interact with them, and we are going to build off of their recommendations to give local ideas and local control access to the riches of the Science Museum by bringing our school-based programs into the greater Minnesota and bringing greater Minnesota into our museum through resource distribution, field trips, and conferencing. Finally, we'll continue with our partnership that began with the Minnesota Historical Society in digitizing much of our collection and working to digitize and display the Native American artifacts that are a rich part of the history of our museum and our state. We will steward these resources and these opportunities to tell stories, to inspire the next generation, and to assure that in our future, our past will always be the guiding point. I want to thank you for the opportunity to meet with this committee and for your attention.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your presentation and the work that you do, Dr. Jolly.
Thank you.
Your request to be laid over for possible inclusion. The Duluth Children's Museum.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee.
Good afternoon.
My name is Rich Chaworski. I am the Vice President of Operations, Programs, and Collections at the Duluth Children's Museum. And I have with me here today one of our members of the Board of our Trustees, Mr. John Erickson. And I would like to thank you for giving us the opportunity to come here again. We were here on February 8th presenting, and I think that we shared with the committee the successes of our programming that we had done. And with that programming and the continuing of that programming, we are requesting a level funding of the $500,000 that we got for the biennium, for the next biennium. In addition to that, we are requesting a one-time $1.5 million funding for a capital campaign effort to relocate us to a bigger facility. And that's what the presentation that we're going to present and basically strobe through because of the time with our PowerPoint to let you know what we're doing. So the Duluth Children's Museum was established in 1930. It's the fifth oldest children's museum in the nation. And we believe that the cultural legacy funding is an appropriate source to assist us in expanding and reaching the next level of service to the Northland.
Thank you, Chairman and committee members. For the record, my name is John Erickson, Duluth Children's Museum board member. What you see is a concept drawing of the proposed project. It is a adaptive reuse of an existing building that is structurally sound and ideally suited for this purpose. The new museum will span three floors and will include a teaching rooftop. Building has been purchased by the Children's Museum as part of preparation for readying ourselves to start this project.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the key advantages of the location are freeway visibility, close proximity to the Heritage Sports Center, the Boys and Girls Club, and also a neighborhood in need. In this slide that you're looking at right now is of 2010 and the Bubble Festival that we did in collaboration with those other organizations at the Clyde area. We had over 3,200 people from at least four states, Michigan, Wisconsin, North Dakota, Minnesota, take part in this. And the community is embracing this site as the right location, and we're excited for that. Working together as a complex, we can make the most use of a joint facility and the space and the partnership that we enjoy currently with those organizations. We partner in a lot of different programs in terms of outreach and other events, and we will be able to do that more effectively moving to this location.
As part of the Duluth Christmas City of the North Parade this year, community volunteers created the float that you see in the photo. And this float will continue to make appearances throughout the Northland at community celebrations to really reinforce the community involvement in this exciting venture. The questions about the site that was chosen and it being a local destination were raised during a bonding committee site visit a few years ago. Since then, construction has been completed and operations are open for business at the Clyde Park Restaurant and Event Center. The Athletic Republic Fitness Center is open. The Duluth Heritage Sports Center is not only open, but it's fast becoming a premier site for youth hockey tournaments, both regionally and nationally. And additionally, the Boys and Girls Club has located a service center within the Heritage Sports Center. And the Salvation Army Community Service Center is only a block away. The school district, in addition, is in the process of constructing a new middle school within a half mile of this location. Future City of Duluth plans also include extension of the Munger Trail adjacent to this site. Clyde Park, which was, when it started, a dream or a vision, is now a thriving community destination. It will be greatly enhanced by the relocation of the Duluth Children's Museum. A recent local initiative support corporation study identified the Children's Museum as a key economic partner in leveraging the public and private partnership that reclaimed this former brownfield site.
And Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we're actively engaged in the marketing of this area to the community with all the other organizations that are currently there.
Currently, the museum exists within about 3,000 square feet, often spilling out in every nook and cranny for special programming events, such as First Fridays that have been attendance approach up to about 500. The new facility will triple the available programming space to 24,000 square feet. That will include a lower-level 100-seat theater space, space for traveling exhibits on the main level, second-level galleries for collection displays and additional educational programming, and an additional 4,000 square feet of rooftop garden space to allow for teaching of renewable energy concepts and green building programming opportunities.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we need this expanded program space for some of the things that the cultural legacy funds have been enabled us to do with our programs. We are expanding our target age range and trying to make this a family experience. And since then, we've launched into some important national collaborations. The NISE Network, the Nanoscale Informal Science Education. We're currently engaged with the Association of Science and Technology Center Youth Inspired Program. And we're also planning to be a networking coordinator with the NASA's BEST program. As you can see, this is just one of the events that we have been involved in. I think this was the air show, but it shows the involvement of volunteers and how the community has embraced the programs that we have to offer.
This project will create over 6,000 labor hours for the construction trades as a small stimulus for our community.
I just wanted to stress that it's going to take the action and support of everyone. Children get to be children only once, and I think that they deserve our commitment to the development of their potential. They need to know that we granted them the reality of a bright future, and that's what this effort is for. It's for them and their future. State dollars will not only stimulate local and national giving, they'll be leveraged at a rate of over 2-1. Here you have a breakdown of how that structure would look like. The State Arts and Cultural Legacy support would be $1,500,000. Foundation support, $500,000. Corporate and business support, $275,000. Special events, fundraisers, $250,000. And then we're expecting to capture individual donations in the amount of $2,250,000. This is a picture of our capital campaign chair. Unfortunately, she wasn't able to be here, but Patty Cartier is a very entrepreneurial business person in our community. community, and she's taken it upon herself to make this mission a reality. And I just wanted to stress that the need is there, and it's really imperative for us. In the 2.5 years that I've been there in my position, I think our membership base at the time was a little over 2,000. We are currently reaching close to the 8,000 mark in terms of individual members, and the small square footage that we have right now can't possibly accommodate any 10% of our members at any given point in time. And the interest that within the community is great. We were just at the Family Fun Festival this past weekend at the DEC. We helped children make 1,300 pinwheels, that's our logo, in some of the activities that we did over those 2 days. We distributed over 200 flyers of our programs that we have available, over 50 membership brochures, and well over 25 volunteer brochures. So the community has really embraced the visibility of the Children's Museum and all the programs that it has to offer, and we hope the Cultural Legacy Funds continue to provide that for our youth in our area. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Your request will be considered for possible inclusion in our bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Como.
Good afternoon.
Welcome.
My name is Michelle Furr. I'm the campus manager and director of Como Park Zoo and Conservatory. Thank you for having me back again today. As you know, Como Park Zoo and Conservatory is one of the top visited cultural attractions in the state of Minnesota, with over 2 million visitors in 2010. To give you a comparison or a perception of how much that our reach is, if you combine the Walker Art Center and Sculpture Garden, the Ordway Center, the Landscape Arboretum, the History Center, and Children's Theater combined, we serve more people than they do every year. Como is also free. We don't charge for admission, we don't charge for parking, we don't charge for new exhibits or daily activities. So really that we reach, there's very few places in Minnesota that reach underserved community as Como does, as well as a family, regardless of their income level, a place for recreational educational opportunities. I was recently here and shared with the committee the great achievements that we did with our past investment of the Legacy Cultural Arts and Legacy Amendment funds. Our request is for $1 million per year of the next cycle, which will allow us to accomplish the following program additions representing programs and projects that preserve and promote Minnesota's history and cultural heritage. You all received a letter that kind of outlined, I'll briefly touch on some of the program pieces that we would utilize the funds and invest in. One of the major themes for us as part of our accreditation through the Association of Zoos and Aquariums is education and education programming. So you'll see that theme in a variety of the projects that we're presenting. Our mobile education, bringing our outreach to not just the Twin Cities area as well as the greater state. Right now we serve tens of thousands of school-aged children on field trips, but we also go to those schools within a 60-mile radius, but this would broaden that horizon as well as bring those students to the campus. Special exhibits, we were very successful in bringing blooming butterflies and ribbit exhibit, which will be opening soon, as well as lion's mane and some art exhibits. This really gets people excited about learning something new. So we're offering exhibits on a temporary basis as well as some small permanent installations, and interpretive signage and interactives. One of the other elements of Como's history is the formal gardens, and many of you have been on visits to the campus. I know we've taken some bus trips and had to make that long walk from the parking bus drop-off all the way up. So improvements to the access for visitors in a variety of ADA as well as just giving people that access, as well as restoring some of those formal gardens. And the Frog Pond and Lay Pond, that was an 1880s installation that needs some work and some updating, as well as some interpretive pieces. And then the other element is bringing some arts to the conservatory. The Marjorie McNeely Conservatory is actually listed on the national, it's registered in the National Historic Landmark. And one of the pieces that we'd like to do is bring music under glass and offer not only the conservatory to different times of the year, as well as partnering with public radio or local television stations to promote that. We ask you for the continued support and ask that you invest in Como Park Zoo and Conservatory. A $1 million allocation from the Cultural Legacy Funds will help ensure future generations to enjoy and learn about the animals and plants and planet Earth for not just today, but also for their grandparents and parents and great-grandparents that we've served. Thank you, and I'm available for any questions that you may have.
Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you receive any other state funding? Chair Erdahl, Representative.
Ms. Buehr.
We do receive funding. We have done bonding in the past, and then we do have a portion of our funding that comes from the O&M through Met Council because we're part of the regional park.
Well, thank you.
Thank
Your
you.
Request will be considered as part of our omnibus bill.
Thank you.
Humanity Center, Mr. O'Fallon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. And given the press of time, I'll cut directly to this. I'm very concerned with the results of the programs and the impact of the programs at the Humanity Center. And I would propose to you that we keep the current level of funding, which has allowed us to do two things specifically that have had a real and measurable impact, which you have in front of you. One is the work with the Council of Colors that has led us to new content and a new way of looking at results that have actually measurably impacted the achievement gap. I think you have a handout in front of you, and I would suggest that you look at the top of the page. You can see what our current funding is, and then to the bottom of the page where you see a chart that shows an impact on the achievement gap, and I have a lot more information on that. That is possible because of the legacy funding and the cooperative work with the Councils of Color, new content, new information, connected with a very innovative approach to professional education. We have a sentence in the middle of that page that I would call to your attention. The solution to the achievement gap is found in Minnesota's communities and cultures and in the innovative professional development method. So this is underway, and again, it's about results and impact. On the back of this, you'll see a map, and I want to point this out to you because the Humanities Center brings information, expert resources, advice to communities all over the state so they can work on issues of connective tissue across cultures, of understanding local history, of developing stronger communities. They work on issues that they choose to work on. And we have measures of success to show, again, a real impact of these programs on these communities. One quick example from the Dassel area, that community is, like so many in Minnesota, undergoing significant change, and they are looking at talking with Native American historians, with Asian Pacific people, with councils of color resources so they can understand the changes in their own community with the help and the support of the Humanities Center.
Well, they have the enlightened attitude of many people from Meeker County.
I think Meeker County is especially enlightened, Mr. Chair, and members. Enough of that, I believe, for the moment. But at any rate, it is a particularly strong example of a community looking into its future. So this is a statewide resource. We have to be innovative because we're small. I love to say that we don't have any authority. Nobody has to work with us. But over the last couple of years, 200 communities and over 80,000 people have chosen to work with the resources of the Minnesota Humanities Center. The increased funding that you see the request for is just $300,000 more than the current level of funding. And that would allow us to look at and invest in the programs that have the real impact, including using, we do have online courses going on right now. We'd like to develop those more completely and work in partnership with some of the other state agencies to deliver them more completely. So, Mr. Chair, members, given the press of time, I'll pause there and be happy to take any questions.
Anyone? Well, thank you, Mr. O'Fallon. Appreciate your presentation and the work that you do, and your request will be included in our consideration in our omnibus bill.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you very much indeed.
Last but not least, we have Lisa Radzik with NPR.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lisa Radzik with Minnesota Public Radio. Thank you for the opportunity to be back before you to present NPR's request for arts and cultural heritage funding for fiscal years 12 and 13. I want to be sure to respect the committee's request to keep our presentation brief. With that in mind, I prepared a very condensed handout, which was included in your packet. NPR's planning for FY 12 and 13 legacy fund investments include a total of $3.3 million, which is outlined on your handouts that are included in your packets. Our planning takes place under the with the goals in mind of providing arts, arts education, and arts access across Minnesota through funding from the amendments Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. The dollar amounts in the sheet that I provided in the packets reflect project groupings, which include as ways to meet these goals, which include direct education, on-air broadcasts, online access, and live performances. Just some examples of the ways we will meet these goals of providing arts, arts education, and arts access through direct education include Play It Forward, Classical Minnesota Public Radio's Used Instruments Drive, Artists in Residence Master Classes for students of all ages across Minnesota. We hold classes with our artists in residence. Learning to Listen, community classes with classical music hosts to help people have easier access to classical music. We will also meet these goals through on-air broadcasts. Projects that fall under this umbrella include Art Hounds, a weekly broadcast of artists that share with NPR listeners, over 40,000 listeners a week, their take on the must-see shows and exhibits from around the state. A Greater Minnesota Arts Reporter to uncover all that is happening in Greater Minnesota with the art scene. The Current Presents, a weekly show highlighting unique themes presented by a guest host each week. We will meet these goals through online components, which include internet pages for our Minnesota Digital Audio Archive, expanded online arts and cultural events calendar, which showcase arts and events across Minnesota, and an All Minnesota Music Stream, which will provide 24/7 streaming of all Minnesota musicians on The Current. And finally, we will meet these goals through performances and live events, including projects like Minnesota Varsity, a new classical performance contest for Minnesota students, WITS, a live show, a series of shows showcasing the art of being a writer, and Scarecrow on Fire with Kevin Kling, a Thanksgiving weekend family event that was a huge success this current biennium. Again, these are just some examples, Mr. Chair, and with that, I stand for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Radzik. Any questions, comments, anything? Well then, thank you. We'll keep this for consideration in our omnibus bill. Was there anyone else out there who wanted to ask us for anything today? Well, King, this case is closed.